Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mordell, reading The Runaway Skyscraper by Murray Leinster. Part 6. Arthur urged the elevator boy to greater speed. They were speeding up the shaft as rapidly as possible, but it was not fast enough. When at last they reached the height at which the excitement seemed to be centered, the car was stopped with a jerk, and Arthur dashed down the hall. Half a dozen frightened stenographers stood there, huddled together. "What's the matter?" Arthur demanded. Men were running from the other floors to see what the trouble was.
"The windows broke, and something flew in at us,"
one of them gasped. There was a crash inside the nearest office, and the women screamed again. Arthur drew a revolver from his pocket and advanced to the door. He quickly threw it open, entered, and closed it behind him. Those left out in the hall waited tensely. There was no sound. The women began to look even more frightened. The men shuffled their feet uneasily and looked uncomfortably at one another. Van Deventer appeared on the scene, puffing a little from his haste. The door opened again, and Arthur came out. He was carrying something in his hands. He had put his revolver aside and looked somewhat foolish, but very much delighted. "The food question is settled," he said happily. "Look." He held out the object he carried. It was a bird, apparently a pigeon of some sort. It seemed to have been stunned, but as Arthur held it out, it stirred, then struggled, and in a moment was flapping wildly in an attempt to escape. "It's a wood pigeon," said Arthur. "They must fly after dark sometimes. A big flock of them ran afoul of the tower and were dazed by the light. They've broken a lot of windows, I dare say, but a great many of them ran into the stonework and were stunned. I was outside the tower, and when I came in, they were dropping to the ground by hundreds. I didn't know what they were then, but if we wait 20 minutes or so, I think we can go out and gather up our supper and breakfast and several other meals all at once." Estelle had appeared and now reached out her hands for the bird. "I'll take care of this one," she said. "Wouldn't it be a good idea to see if there aren't some more stunned in the other offices?" In half an hour, the electric stoves of the restaurant were going at their full capacity. Men, cheerfully excited men now, were bringing in pigeons by armfuls, and other men were skinning them. There was no time to pluck them, though a great many of the women were busily engaged in that occupation. As fast as the birds could be cooked, they were served out to the impatient but much cheered castaways. And in a little while, nearly every person in the place was walking casually about the halls with a roasted, broiled, or fried pigeon in his hands. The ovens were roasting pigeons, the frying pans were frying them, the broilers were loaded down with the small but tender birds. The unexpected solution of the most pressing question cheered everyone amazingly. Many people were still frightened, but less frightened than before. Worry for their families still oppressed a great many, but the removal of the fear of immediate hunger led them to believe that the other problems before them would be solved too, and in as satisfactory a manner. Arthur had returned to his office with 4 broiled pigeons in a sheet of wrapping paper. As he somehow expected, Estelle was waiting there. "Thought I'd bring lunch up," he announced. "Are you hungry?"
"Starving," Estelle replied and laughed. The whole catastrophe began to become an adventure. She bit eagerly into a bird. Arthur began as hungrily on another. For some time, neither spoke a word. At last, however, Arthur waved the leg of his second pigeon toward his desk.
"Look what we've got here," he said. Estelle nodded. The stunned pigeon Arthur had first picked up
was tied by one foot to a paperweight.
"I thought we might keep him for a souvenir," she suggested.
"You seem pretty confident we'll get back all right," Arthur observed. "It was surely lucky those blessed birds came along. They've heartened up the people wonderfully."
"Oh, I knew you'd manage somehow," said Estelle confidently.
"I manage?" Arthur repeated, smiling. "What have I done?"
"Why, you've done everything," affirmed Estelle stoutly. "You've told the people what to do from the very first, and you're going to get us back."
Arthur grinned. Then suddenly his face grew a little more serious.
"I wish I were as sure as you are," he said.
"I think we'll be all right, though, sooner or later."
"I'm sure of it," Estelle declared with conviction. "Why, you..."
"Why, I?" asked Arthur again. He bent forward in his chair and fixed his eyes on Estelle's. She looked up, met his gaze, and stammered.
You do things," she finished lamely.
"I'm tempted to do something now," Arthur said. "Look here, Miss Woodward, you've been in my employ for 3 or 4 months. In all that time, I've never had anything but the most impersonal comments from you. Why the sudden change?" The twinkle in his eyes robbed his words of any impertinence.
I really suppose I never noticed you before," said Estelle.
"Please notice me hereafter," said Arthur. "I've been noticing you. I've been doing practically nothing else." Estelle flushed again. She tried to meet Arthur's eyes and failed. She bit desperately into her pigeon drumstick, trying to think of something to say.
"When we get back," went on Arthur meditatively, "I'll have nothing to do, no work or anything. I'll be broke and out of a job."
Estelle shook her head emphatically. Arthur paid no attention.
"Estelle," he said, smiling, "would you like to be out of a job with me?"
Estelle turned crimson. "I'm not very successful," Arthur went on soberly. "I'm afraid I wouldn't make a very good husband. I'm rather worthless and lazy."
"You aren't," broke in Estelle. You're...
Arthur reached over and took her by the shoulders.
"What?"
he demanded. She would not look at him, but she did not draw away. He held her from him for a moment.
"What am I?" he demanded again.
Somehow he found himself kissing the tips of her ears. Her face was buried against his shoulder.
"What am I?" he repeated sternly.
Her voice was muffled by his coat.
You're a dear," she said.
There was an interlude of about a minute and a half, then she pushed him away from her.
"Don't," she said breathlessly. "Please don't."
"Aren't you going to marry me?" he demanded. Still crimson, she nodded shyly. He kissed her again.
"Please don't," she protested.
She fondled the lapels of his coat, quite content to have his arms about her.
"Oh, why mayn't I kiss you, if you're going to marry me?" Arthur demanded.
She looked up at him with an air of demure primness.
"You've been eating pigeon," she told him in mock gravity, "and your mouth is greasy."
It was 2 weeks later. Estelle looked out over the now familiar wild landscape. It was much the same when she looked far away, but nearby there were great changes. A cleared trail led through the woods to the waterfront, and a raft of logs extended out into the river for hundreds of feet. Both sides of the raft were lined with busy fishermen, men and women too. A little to the north of the base of the building, a huge mound of earth smoked sullenly. The coal in the cellar had given out, and charcoal had been found to be the best substitute they could improvise. The mound was where the charcoal was made. It was heartbreaking work to keep the fires going with charcoal, because it burned so rapidly in the powerful draft of the furnaces. but the original Fireroom gang had been recruited to several times its original number from among the Towerites, and the work was divided until it did not seem hard. As Estelle looked down, two tiny figures sauntered across the clearing from the woods with a heavy animal slung between them. One of them was using a gun as a walking stick. Estelle saw the flash of the sun on its polished metal barrel. There were a number of Indians in the clearing, watching with wide-open eyes the activities of the whites. Dozens of birch-bark canoes dotted the Hudson, each with its load of fishermen, industriously working for the white people. It had been hard to overcome the fear of the Indians, and they still paid superstitious reverence to the whites, but fair dealings, coupled with a constant readiness to defend themselves, had enabled Arthur to institute a system of trading for food that had so far proved satisfactory. The whites had found spare electric light bulbs valuable currency in dealing with the red men. Picture wire, too, was highly prized. There was not a picture left hanging in any of the offices. Metal paper knives brought huge quantities of provisions from the eager Indian traders, and the story was current in the tower that Arthur had received 8 canoe loads of corn and vegetables in exchange for a broken-down typewriter. No one could guess what the savages wanted with the typewriter, but they had carted it away triumphantly. Estelle smiled tenderly to herself as she remembered how Arthur had been the leading spirit in all the numberless enterprises in which the castaways had been forced to engage. He would come to her in a spare 10 minutes and tell her how everything was going. He seemed curiously boy-like in those moments. Sometimes he would come straight from the fire room. He insisted on taking part in all the more arduous duties. Having hastily cleaned himself for her inspection, snatch a hurried kiss, then go off laughing to help chop down trees for the long fishing raft. He had told them how to make charcoal, had taken a leading part in establishing and maintaining friendly relations with the Indians, and was now down in the deepest sub-basement, working with a gang of volunteers to try to put the building back where it belonged. Estelle had said after the collapse of the flooring in the boardroom that she heard a sound like the rushing of waters. Arthur, on examining the floor where the safe deposit vault stood, found it had risen an inch. On these facts he had built up his theory. The building, like all modern skyscrapers, rested on concrete piles extending down to bedrock. In the center of one of those piles, there was a hollow tube, originally intended to serve as an artesian well. The flow had been insufficient, and the well had been stopped up. Arthur, of course, as an engineer, had studied the construction of the building with great care, and happened to remember that this partly hollow pile was the one nearest the safe deposit vault. The collapse of the boardroom had suggested that some change had happened in the building itself, and that was found when he saw that the deposit vault had actually risen an inch. He at once connected the rise in the flooring above the hollow pile with the pipe in the pile. Estelle had heard liquid sounds. Evidently water had been forced into the hollow artesian pipe under an unthinkable pressure when the catastrophe occurred. From the rumbling and the suddenness of the whole catastrophe, a volcanic or seismic disturbance was evident. The connection of volcanic or seismic action with a flow of water suggested a geyser or a hot spring of some sort, probably a spring which had been broken through its normal confines some time before, but whose pressure had been sufficient to prevent the accident until the failure of its flow. When the flow ceased, the building sank rapidly. For the fact that this sinking was in the fourth direction, the fourth dimension, Arthur had no explanation. He simply knew that in some mysterious way, an outlet for the pressure had developed in that fashion, and that the tower had followed the spring in its fall through time. The sole apparent change in the building had occurred above the one hollow concrete pile, which seemed to indicate that if access were to be had to the mysterious, and so far only assumed, spring, it must be through that pile. While the vault retained its abnormal elevation, Arthur believed that there was still water, at an immense and incalculable pressure, in the pipe. He dared not attempt to tap the pipe until the pressure had abated. At the end of a week, he found the vault slowly settling back into place. When its return to normal was complete, he dared to begin boring a hole to reach the hollow tube in the concrete pile. As he suspected, he found water in the pile, water whose sulfurous and mineral nature confirmed his belief that a geyser reaching deep into the bosom of the earth, as well as far back in the realms of time, was at the bottom of the extraordinary jaunt of the tower. Geysers were still far from satisfactory things to explain. There are many of their vagaries which we cannot understand at all. We do know a few things which affect them, and one thing is that soaping them will stimulate their flow in an extraordinary manner. Arthur proposed to soap this mysterious geyser when the renewal of its flow should lift the runaway skyscraper back to the epoch from which the failure of the flow had caused it to fall. He made his preparations with great care. He confidently expected his plan to work and to see the skyscraper once more towering over Midtown New York, as was its wont, but he did not allow the fishermen and hunters to relax their efforts on that account. They labored as before, while deep down in the sub-basement of the colossal building, Arthur and his volunteers toiled mightily. They had to bore through the concrete pile until they reached the hollow within it. Then, when the evidence gained from the water in the pipe had confirmed his surmises, they had to prepare their charge of soapy liquids by which the geyser was to be stirred to renewed activity. Great quantities of the soap used by the scrub women in scrubbing down the floors was boiled with water until a syrupy mess was evolved. Means had then to be provided by which this could be quickly induced into the hollow pile, the hole then closed, and then braced to withstand a pressure unparalleled in hydraulic science. Arthur believed that from the hollow pile the soapy liquid would find its way to the geyser proper, where it would take effect in stimulating the lessened flow to its former proportions. When that took place, he believed that the building would return as swiftly and as surely as it had left them to normal modern times. The telephone rang in his office and Estelle answered it. Arthur was on the wire. A signal was being hung out for all the castaways to return to the building from their several occupations. They were about to soap the geyser. Did Estelle want to come down and watch? She did. She stood in the main hallway as the excited and hopeful people trooped in. When the last was inside, the doors were firmly closed. The few friendly Indians outside stared perplexedly at the mysterious white strangers. The whites, laughing excitedly, began to wave to the Indians. Their leave-taking was premature. Estelle took her way down into the cellar. Arthur was awaiting her arrival. Van Deventer stood near, with the grinning, grimy members of Arthur's volunteer work gang. The massive concrete pile stood in the center of the cellar. A big steam boiler was coupled to a tiny pipe that led into the heart of the mass of concrete. Arthur was going to force the soapy liquid into the hollow pile by steam. At a signal, steam began to hiss in the boiler. Live steam from the fire room forced the soapy syrup out of the boiler through the small iron pipe into the hollow that led to the geyser far underground. 6,000 gallons in all were forced into the opening in a space of 3 minutes. Arthur's grimy gang began to work with desperate haste. Quickly, they withdrew the iron pipe and inserted a long steel plug, painfully beaten from a bar of solid metal. Then, girding the colossal concrete pile, ring after ring of metal was slipped on to hold the plug in place. The last of the safeguards was hardly fastened firmly when Estelle listened intently.
"I hear a rumbling," she said quietly.
Arthur reached forward and put his hand on the mass of concrete.
"It is quivering," he reported as quietly. "I think we'll be on our way in a very little while."
The group broke for the stairs to watch the panorama as the runaway skyscraper made its way back through the thousands of years to the times that had built it for a monument to modern commerce. Arthur and Estelle went high up into the tower. From the window of Arthur's office, they looked eagerly and felt the slight quiver as the tower got under way. Estelle looked up at the sun and saw it mend its pace toward the west. Night fell. The evening sounds became high-pitched and shrill, then seemed to cease altogether. In a very little while there was light again, and the sun was speeding across the sky. It sank hastily and returned almost immediately via the east. Its pace became a breakneck rush, down behind the hills, up in the east, down in the west, up in the east, down and up. The flickering began. The race back toward modern times had started. Arthur and Estelle stood at the window and looked out as the sun rushed more and more rapidly across the sky until it became but a streak of light, shifting first to the right and then to the left as the seasons passed in their turn. With Arthur's arms about her shoulders, Estelle stared out across the unbelievable landscape, while the nights and days, the winters and summers, and the storms and calms of 1,000 years swept past them into the irrevocable past. Presently Arthur drew her to him and kissed her. While he kissed her, so swiftly did the days and years flee by. 3 generations were born, grew and begot children, and died again. Estelle held fast in Arthur's arms, thought nothing of such trivial things. She put her arms about his neck and kissed him, while the years passed them unheeded. "Of course you know that the building landed safely in the exact hour, minute, and second from which it started, so that when the frightened and excited people poured out of it to stand in Madison Square and feel that the world was once more right side up, their hilarious and incomprehensible conduct made such of the world as was passing by think a contagious madness had broken out. Days passed before the story of the 2000 was believed, but at last it was accepted as truth. An eminent scientist studied the matter exhaustively. Now, there has been one rather queer result of the journey of the runaway skyscraper. A certain Isidore Eckstein, a dealer in jewelry novelties, whose office was in the tower when it disappeared into the past, has entered suit in the courts of the United States against all the holders of land on Manhattan Island. It seems that during the 2 weeks in which the tower rested in the wilderness, he traded independently with 2 of the Indian chiefs and exchanged 2 pearl necklaces, 16 finger rings, and $1 in money, and received a title deed to the entire island. He claims that his deed is a conveyance made previous to all other sales whatever. Strictly speaking, he is undoubtedly right, as his deed was signed before the discovery of America. The courts, however, are deliberating the question with a great deal of perplexity. Eckstein is quite confident that in the end his claim will be allowed, and he will be admitted as the sole owner of real estate on Manhattan Island, with all occupiers of buildings and territory paying him ground rent at a rate he will fix himself. In the meantime, though, the foundations are being reinforced so that the catastrophe cannot occur again. His entire office is packed full of articles suitable for trading with the Indians. If the tower makes another trip back through time, Eckstein hopes to become a landholder of some importance. No less than 87 books have been written by members of the memorable 2000 in description of their trip to the hinterland of time. But Arthur, who could write more intelligently about the matter than anyone else, is so extremely busy that he cannot bother with such things. He has two very important matters to look after. One is, of course, the reinforcement of the foundations of the building so that a repetition of the catastrophe cannot occur. And the other is to convince his wife, who is Estelle naturally, that she is the most adorable person in the universe. He finds the latter task the more difficult because she insists that he is the most adorable person. Please join me next time for another exciting story here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Thank you.